This is Six Music.
Available at the Six Music website and every morning at 4 a.m. BBC Radio Six Music documentaries.
Telling the stories in music that matter.
It was the first airing it's ever had anywhere.
Really?
My mother thought the lyrics were dirty.
Baby, baby, brush the dust of youth from off your shoulder.
From the story of pop to Marvin Gaye.
You know, I'm a lot of people and a lot of things, and I just have to express all of me.
Now, Six Music Documentaries present Master Tapes.
Welcome to Master Tapes and to Wilco Johnson playing Roxette, a Thames Delta classic from Down by the Jetty, the 1975 debut album from his band Dr. Feelgood. The record also included the likes of All Through the City, Keep It Out of Sight and She Does It Right.
She does it right.
Wilco Johnson, welcome to Master Tapes.
Thank you.
A programme in which we'll take you back through the making of the album that launched your recording career. And when it hit the shops in January 1975, Down by the Jetty marked Dr. Feelgood well apart from almost every other band around at the time. Amid glam rock and prog rock and soft pop, Dr. Feelgood were lean and mean in both sound and looks, playing fast, furious rhythm and blues. Was that always the intention, to go against the grain of what was happening in 74, 75?
I don't think we had any intentions when we started. We were a local band. We were all from Canvey Island, and we wanted to play what back then we called rhythm and blues music. You can't call it that anymore. A different thing now. Call it beat music. But we wanted to play that locally. It wasn't very fashionable at the time, and that was our only intention.
And it was aggressive music, and that was largely driven by your guitar playing style, choppy, and you're playing always with your fingers.
Yeah. I am actually left-handed, you see. Now, us sinistralists generally play the guitar this way round, right? And when I started playing, I'd learn to play this way round.
But just for the benefit of the listeners at home, you've turned the guitar
upside
down.
I'm pointing it a la Paul McCartney, right? Anyway, I really wasn't very good. Everybody at school could play better than me. After a while, I found a second-hand right-handed guitar. I thought, what I'll do is I'll turn over and learn to play right-handed, and I'll tell myself I've only just started, so I won't feel such a duffer. And so I did, so I learned to play right-handed, and it's worked out marvellously. And think of all the money I've saved on plectrums.
And you always gave the impression in the sound that was recorded on those records, and for anybody who saw Dr. Feelgood live, it sounded like you were playing rhythm and lead guitar at the same time.
Yeah, my guitar hero was Mick Green, who played for Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, and he it was who had invented this fantastic percussive style of playing, which involves stabs. They might call stab like that, see? Quick chord, right? And you can make rhythms with them. Now, I tried and I tried, but I could never play as good as Greeny. And I kind of ended up with my style, which is a bit like riding a bike, actually. It's very easy to do, but difficult to describe. But put it very simply, and it is very simple, it's his right hand, right, which is playing the rhythm. And it's just all the time going eight in the bar like this. Just like that all the time. You watch that right hand, don't change, just keeps doing that all the time, right? Now, in among all that, you can put in stabs, like that, you see. You can also put in a little lick, like that. And that's how it's done. You now know the whole of my technique.
And this album that we're talking about in this programme, Down by the Jetty, it's a sound of raw energy, and it was really important when you went to the studio to capture that live sound, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, looking back on doing this album, and it is a long time, so, you know, I might either have lapses of memory or I might actually be lying. You never know, right? But I'll tell you the way I remember it happening. This was in the mid-70s, and by that time, the techniques of multi-track recording had developed quite a bit. I mean, famously, Sgt. Pepper was recorded on a four-track recording machine. By the time we came to make our first album, 32 tracks was standard. And this meant that every record you heard, you would hear about 10 guitars all dubbed on one after the other, and just, it was terrible. The records I really loved, had grown up to love, you could listen to them and you could hear it was a band playing. You could hear one guitar, one bass, a drum kit, and a piano maybe, and the singer. But there weren't 50 guitars dubbed on. This tyranny, really, of multi-tracking had taken over recording to the extent where recording engineers, what they like was separation. It was separation. Yeah, what's this separation, man? They want the drummer and the bass player to go in first on their own and go, then they want the guitar player to come on and dub on about 10 guitars over the top of that, and then eventually you end up with this manufactured, smooth, well, like a sort of musical Karamak, really. It was horrible. In fact, when we started to record, the producer got the drummer, Figure, and Sparko, the bass player, into the studio going boom, 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 boom. And I knew that next he was going to ask me to come in and put on about four guitars. And anyway, I threw a wobbler. I was quite good at that in those days. I was quite a ballerina, right? And I threw my dinner plate against the wall and I stamped my foot. And I said, I ain't bleeding playing like that. What I wanted to do was what you should do, which is set the band up the way it is on stage, and then it's the recording engineer's job to record that sound. It's not their place to tell the musicians to stand there with headphones on and to come in and play. You don't do a gig. Right, first of all, let's welcome the drummer and the bass player, right? You know, I mean, what would it be like? The separation. Oh, you get spillage. They go, spillage? You go, you're talking about spillage, man. I'll tell you what, take me somewhere in this wonderful world of ours where you get separation. It doesn't happen, does it? You walk in the street, you've got a lot of spillage. That's the real universe, man. I mean, and recording engineers like to rub it out. So anyway, we started to record the thing like that, with us all playing together in the studio and me just refusing to do any overdubs, and so that to make the most of what that was.
So you were uncompromising from the start. That attitude followed through with the way that you played the guitar, the sound of the guitar. You've got your trusty Telecaster on your lap today and the pickup selector jammed to the bridge pickup. And it always has been on that one, which gives that very distinctive trebly sound.
It does. That's the kind of hard sound. In fact, I don't need these knobs because they just both turn up full. And this switch is back, so it's that one, and that's it. I don't mess around. You know, you turn the amplifier about halfway, and you can play.
You've never experimented with sounds, with effects, pedals.
Listen, man, I'm a guitar player, not a cyclist.
And you were the sole songwriter, of course, when you went into the studio. You look at the writing credits on Down by the Jetty. Yeah. They're all yours apart from a couple of covers.
Yeah. When we were playing in London, we were becoming popular, and before we signed a record deal... Record, right, for the younger people here, a record. It's kind of a bunch of downloads glued onto a piece of vinyl. Right. But I'd started writing the songs, yeah. That's your first album, so it's all very exciting and you don't feel pressure. You just want to get in and do it.
Now, there's been a huge upsurge of interest in your work, especially in recent weeks. You and I did an interview which had such an amazing response from listeners because of your attitude to your fate. I mean, you talked there about having terminal illness. Yeah. You have pancreatic cancer and you've decided to go out in style, on stage, with your fans.
Not literally go out. I mean, don't buy a ticket hoping you can see me keel over. Right at the moment, thank you very much, I feel fit as a fiddle and fine. And they've told me that I've got maybe another few months until the cancer actually starts doing its work and killing me. So while I'm fit, I do want to do as much as I can. As soon as I start feeling the sickness, that will be that. I don't want to be on a stage like that, no.
You came out with some fantastically evocative phrases. You talked about feeling vividly alive when we spoke before. And you're still feeling like that.
I am, actually. I mean, the initial euphoria I felt has kind of levelled off a bit now. But I still feel in high spirits, if you like. It makes you feel you're kind of cut off from the rest of the human race. You know, you walk in a crowded street and you think, look at all these people, and they're all subject to mortality. Right, but mine's sorted out. I don't have to worry about that, right? And you walk along, you think, yeah, you know, and it kind of makes you feel a bit special, which is good for a show-off like me.
And Dr. Feelgood formed famously in Canvey Island in 1971, but after you had been off to university studying Icelandic sagas and Anglo-Saxon literature,
yep.
Then you'd gone off on the classic hippie trail. You'd been to Afghanistan and Iran, and you ended up in India.
Yeah.
And then returned to Canvey Island. Now, you saw places that a lot of people can only dream about. Why did you go back to those oil refineries?
I don't know. I mean, I do consider the Thames Estuary to be one of the most beautiful landscapes in the world. Is it because I was born and grew up there? I mean, literally in the estuary. I mean, Canvey Island is actually below sea level. So, you know, I was born below sea level. And the influence of these submarine origins on my music must have been marvellous, you know. So, I don't know, I just feel at home there.
And sartorially, you've always been in the black suit, the boots. But, of course, when you came back from your hippie trail, you're wearing an Afghan coat, I presume, and long hair.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I kept this Afghan coat. And sometime last year, there's all these insects flying about, man. You know, I had to declare chemical warfare on them and all that, you know. Then I got rid of them. And a few days later, I'm looking under the stairs for something or other, and I open this empty suitcase, and there's this kind of square of parchment with all these eggs around it. And I realised what would happen. These things that I had murdered were, in fact, moths who had eaten my Afghan coat, completely, all of the fur, all of the embroidery and everything, and just left this square of goat skin.
So you get back to Canvey Island, and you hook up with some people that you knew from the past, and let's just go through the cast list, because we have the big figure on the drums,
yeah,
a man who was, when he was a kid, known as John Martin, and yeah, you were at school yeah, with John, little Johnny Martin.
Yeah. Johnny Martin, we were born just around the corner from each other, almost contemporaneously. Indeed, our mothers used to push us around in our prams together and all that. You know, I don't remember a lot of that. But anyway, he has literally been a lifelong friend.
Right. And then there's John Sparks, who became Sparko yeah, on the bass. And then, of course, Lee Brillo, your yeah, singer, who was born Lee Collinson. When did you first meet Lee? Had you known him at school?
No. Lee was about 5 years younger than me. And before I went to university, when I was about 18, I used to have this, what we called a jug band. It was a skiffle group, really. We used to play on the street and play Lead Belly songs and stuff like that. And we used to go down the seafront on Canvey, and you wait till the pubs are coming out, and they'll come out, they're all a bit half-cut, right? And you start playing. You play a sad one, you know, like, You Are My Sunshine or something like that, right? And they come out and give you a 10-bob note and everything. It's really good. So we were doing this one time, and these three boys came up to us. They were about 13 years old. Now, these three boys were, in fact, Sparko, Lee Brillo, and Chris Fenwick, who became the Feelgood's manager in the fullness of time. But the one I remember was Lee. You couldn't forget this guy. He had a very dynamic personality. And the next thing I know, they'd started a jug band of their own. And when I used to come home in the summer from university, I would see them playing around and that. And so I knew them from that. That's where I first met Lee.
Right.
But it wasn't until after I came back from India, the Afghan coat still intact, shaggy as anything, and I'm mooching down the road one day, and here comes Lee Brillo. And man, he had this sharp haircut, right, a big sideboard, you know, and he looks so mean. I said, hello, man, how you going? And he's telling me that his jug band had developed into a rock band, and that the guitarist had just left. So they were without a guitarist, and I'm standing there thinking, well, I've still got my guitar, you know, and I wonder if he's going to ask me to join. Well, we kept on talking. He didn't ask me. And, of course, he's looking at me thinking, I wonder if he's going to ask. And anyway, we managed to talk for about half an hour about this without anyone saying anything. And then we parted company, and I went home. Then a little later on that day, knock on the door, and it's John Sparks. And he goes, do you want to join our group? And I said, yes. And that's how it began.
So you quickly come together, and then you're renowned for this manic energy on stage. And a lot of the energy coming from your persona, the wild stare, and the way that you were playing guitar, and the way that you were kind of moving, sort of running, darting across the stage from side to side. Unfortunately, the master tape stage is so cluttered, we won't be able to replicate the movements. Yeah. But I mean, where did that come from? Was that just natural? Was that were just feeling the music?
To me, the origin of the energy of the whole thing came from Lee. In fact, if you look at pictures of Dr. Feelgood, when you see me and Lee, you see I'm looking at him, right? And I would be taking my cue from him.
So you were feeding off his energy?
Yeah, yeah. As for what it was I was doing, I don't know what I was doing. You know, if you go down the disco and you've had a couple of drinks and you hear a song you like and you get up on the floor and you start dancing about. Now, you don't care what kind of an idiot you look. You just want to move like that. And it's exactly the same what I'm doing. You know, the music makes me feel like going along like that. He says, making stiff, jerky movements.
So you were capturing and creating the sound of Canvey Island. You're almost creating a soundtrack. Let's look at the song All Through the City. You got that line, stand and watch the towers burning at the break of day. And those towers that you're referring to are the towers of the oil refinery on the landscape. Yeah. That's something you grew up with. You were aware all the time, I presume, of the smell of the oil as well.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, when I was 5 or 6 years old, in the infant school, I think, they started to build that refinery. And I can remember all day long, you could hear the steam hammers driving the piles into the mud, you know, and boom, boom. And then gradually these towers were rising up from the horizon, you know, and then the whole thing got going and there's this fire, and that's out at the empty end of Canvey Island, right, where you used to go courting, right? So, I mean, I lost my virginity in the shadow of this refinery. So, yes, it's got a place in my heart.
And that couplet, well, that quartet of lines, stand and watch the towers burning at the break of day, still ain't slowing down, been on my feet since yesterday. And this all links with the album cover, doesn't it? Because there's a great photograph, iconic photograph of the band. I've been searching all through the city. See you in the morning down by the jetty. And the photograph on the cover of the album is of the band down by the jetty. And it looks like it's first thing in the morning. The dawn is breaking. In fact, on the back cover, Lee Brillo looks like asleep.
He could well be. It certainly was first thing in the morning. In fact, we played a gig in London the night before, and we'd all crowded into our van and gone back from London with a photographer. And then very early in the morning, we'd gone to the jetty on Canvey Island. Now, the idea was to get a very beautiful colour photograph for this album cover. While we were waiting for the photographer to set up, he took some black and white snaps of us, and we weren't posing them. We were just leaning on the seawall, feeling pretty bad. I mean, we've been up late and everything, right? And these pictures were just, I don't know, tryouts or whatever you call them. And then he spent a long time getting these lovely colour plates. But as soon as I saw the pictures and saw us looking so frazzled, and it was black and white, and I thought, that's the picture.
Well, it's the picture which captures the spirit and the sound in a strange way, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
And it's the kind of the austerity of the image, of the fact it's black and white, the monochrome. Monochrome, also, it's because the album says on the cover that it's recorded in mono. And now you take issue with this, don't you? Because technically you say it's not a mono record.
Well, when it came to mixing this album, you've got a drum kit, a bass guitar, and a guitar behind the voice, and perhaps a keyboard. But, you know, the way they used to do stereo then was silly as well, because they used to push everything out to one side. It's like everybody knows, if you get some of the Beatles albums and turn the pan control right to one side, you can hear Paul McCartney singing on his own.
Yeah. And a bit of bass, maybe. Or
Yeah.
It's totally separated.
Absolutely separated.
Now, word again.
When we came to mixing these things, we got, because it was so sparse, what was shown on the tape, I mean, for instance, if there was, say, a keyboard, then you could put the drums and the bass in the middle and the guitar on one side and the keyboard on the other and have a kind of stereo thing there. But in the end, it was easier to pan everything into the middle, right, which is mono. Now, we ended up with some tracks done like this and other tracks where there was an extra instrument, say, done in stereo with it all separated out. It all made everything sound so different. And it was decided, probably by me, that it would be better to put everything into this mono rather than have this rather unwieldy mix. So that's what we did. Now, when it came to making the album and everything, they'd written mono on the sleeve. And I say, no, please, please don't write mono on the sleeve, because I don't want everybody thinking Dr. Feelgood is some kind of retro Shawaddy Waddy or something like that, you know. I said, don't do that, please, because if you don't write mono, nobody will know. Nobody will know. But if you do write mono, then I'm going to be answering questions of it. And here I am at death's door, still arguing about it. Right?
Lyrically, very direct narrative songs about personal experience. Were you writing about yourself, or you were writing, almost inhabiting the character of Lee Brilliant?
I was, yeah. When I would write a song, I would have the sound of the band and especially Lee's voice in my mind. And so I wanted the lyrics that I wrote to suit his style of singing, and also for the kind of words I was writing to go along with the kind of personality right. he was projecting.
So She Does It Right, for instance.
Yeah.
Who was doing it right, and what was she doing that was so right?
Well, I think actually that was probably my missus, but we don't know, see. With Roxette, for instance, I just started writing songs then. Somehow or other, I couldn't use a proper name in a song. And I got this song, this Roxette. So you got two things in this riff. You got this one going... And the right hand is just going up and down, right? When it comes up, it gives you a... And when it's going... and hours. You got this dun dun. You need a woman's name with two syllables, and it's got to sound a bit raunchy. So I invented the name Roxette, you see. And well, I mean, there are now thousands of unfortunate dogs and cats, and also some humans that have been given this name, not to mention the Swedish pop group who achieved success in the 80s, right? So I was able to walk around going, oh, Roxette's in the charts again, you know.
And it started out in a different form, didn't it? It was almost
it did, yes, you're
it's
right.
It's a doo-wop form originally.
Yeah, one day I've been listening to a Coasters record called Turtle Dovin'. One of these records, you go, ba-doo-la-wop. And I thought, oh, man, I'd really like to do a song like that. So I started thinking this thing, ba-doo-la-wop. I saw you out the other night. And we learned the song like that, and me and Figure will be singing wop bop bop ba doo da wop bop bop. If you can find the Dr. Feelgood box set, which EMI have kindly deleted recently, you can find a live version of this song where we're doing our wop bop bop thing. And in fact, it was so silly, really, that I wasn't even going to use it for the album. And then sitting in the studio, I came up with this... I thought, hang on, that fits. I saw you out the other night. I saw somebody hold you tight. Roxette. I wondered who that could be. It was so dark I couldn't see. But I know it wasn't me. When I tell you it ain't right, I know you got to agree.
Wilco, has the illness, has it made you more sharply aware of what you were doing, what you achieved with Dr. Feelgood? Are you able to appreciate the band more now?
I don't really think about it like that. I don't listen to my own records or look at pictures of it. If I do think about Dr. Feelgood, I just like to look back on the good times we had, really, and what everybody else made of it. That's what they made of it.
And you're heading out on the road and also back into the studio, recording some... And are these new songs?
Just after I've been told I've got terminal cancer, and I come walking out of the hospital, and among a rather lot of impressions, I started writing songs. I feel, you know, it's just like me, leave it to the last minute. You know? Yeah, we've recorded, I think, about 5 songs, a couple of existing ones, but 2 or 3 new ones. There will be an album, I think. No time for messing about. No time for preventing spillage or anything like that, right? We're just going to go in and whack it down and see what we've got.
And are you writing in the same way that you've always written songs? And in fact, what is the given way that you put a song together? You carry notebooks around? Are you always writing down lyrics?
I do indeed usually carry a notebook. I know you asked me to bring one of these along, you see. You go, whoop, I've just
there it is, on the inside pocket.
This is, as I look through, I can see famous songs, you know, Back in the Night and Going Back Home and things like that. But it's also mixed up with accounts of dreams I've had or paragraphs cursing some woman, you know, like who done me wrong and stuff like that. So, and in fact, recently this notebook, there was an exhibition in Southend at the Beecroft Art Gallery of Essex Rock or something, and I lent this notebook to, they had it in a glass case right open at the page where I've written Back in the Night, and I said to a man, don't let anybody Don't let anybody look at any other part of this book, because I mean, some of it is embarrassing, really.
And you have many of those. You collect. Are you your own archivist then?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got a pile of notebooks, if that's what you mean.
They're not in that same cupboard with the Afghan crate. And you say you walked out of that hospital, you saw the world in a different way because of the diagnosis. And are you writing songs about the way you're feeling?
I think the day after this diagnosis, I went up to town where Norman Watroy was putting the finishing touches to his solo album.
Norman's your bassist in your band. Bass player. Used to be with the Blockheads.
Yes, still I stole him from the Blockheads. Yeah. But anyway, going up to the studio with Norman, it feels good to me. I want to go in the studio again. And when we were driving back, I start thinking of these songs. I'm writing these songs. I started writing some lyrics down, and in the morning I noticed that a lot of them tended to be about kind of death, you know, stuff about clocks and stuff like that, you know. And I thought, well, you got to watch it, right? Because, you know, I don't want this to be progressive music or anything. But I think there are some kind of references to the inexorability of the Grim Reaper.
But you're still reining yourself in, Wilco. This is really interesting because you said that when you're writing for Lee Brillo, and he's a tough guy, and you're having to write a certain type of lyric for him, She Does It Right, all through the city. And this is, you know, you're writing as somebody who has seen the world, who studied the sagas, studied Anglo-Saxon literature. You were never tempted to come up with something a bit more flowery and poetic.
Rock and roll's a style. And what rock and roll does, it does brilliantly. I think to try and elaborate it in any way is not doing it any good. And really, what are all rock and roll songs saying? They're saying, I love you, baby, but you done me wrong. And that's it. You know, and I don't think you go further than that.
Well, that's all we have time for in this first part of the programme. There's a lot more to discuss with Wilco about Dr. Feelgood's debut album, Down by the Jetty, about his time with Ian Dury and the Blockheads, and several decades touring the world as a solo artist. So we'll continue this discussion in the second edition of Master Tapes, our B-side, where the studio audience here at Maida Vale get to pose the questions. But for now, Wilco Johnson, thank you very much. Don't forget the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website. You can download today's programme as well as the rest of the series, and there's exclusive content including full versions of the songs played live here at Maida Vale and videos of our Master Tapes guests. And you can tweet us using the hashtag Master Tapes. But we leave you now with Wilco Johnson playing us out with... Wilco, what are you doing? She Does It Right.
She does it right. She does it right. She worked her hard every night. She made me feel alright. Tell me not to worry. There ain't a single trouble in sight. Yeah.
I guess I primarily made mixtapes for myself and then started to give them to other people, like The Clash and The Sex Pistols and The Pretenders. And Patti Smith actually was really hip to my mixtapes.
This is Don Letts.
Get on it. It's your time.
Back in those days, it was like serious currency. It was a way that we communicated with one another. And I think that potential is still there with the radio show. I really think about what I'm going to put out there. I guess my selection reflects my cultural journey. I only play stuff that I really care and passionate about. The only difference with my show is there's a few more beats, a lot more bass. But other than that, I'm all over the place, crossing time, space and genres.
Don Letts, Culture Clash Radio.
Sunday nights from 10.
On BBC Radio.
Six Music. Yeah.